going to shift gears and focus now, basically for the next 4 weeks, on different racial and ethnic groups and sort of the standpoint of these different groups and how their history and perceptions of reality shape their involvement in the modern day workforce and society. And so the first group is African Americans. One interesting critique I have of the book, and someone raised it in their memo, is that, so do we talk about blacks? Do we talk about African Americans? Do we talk about black people? Should it be capitalized? When we talk black and white, should it be capital B or lowercase b? And one critique I have of this book, and it's more of a visceral experience when I read it, when someone uses a term, blacks, it has this subtle dehumanizing effect. And I'll find myself saying, black people, not blacks, but black people, to recognize and reinforce the fact that it isn't them or those people, it's black people. And someone wrote in one of their memos that even they felt it, like their intuition was that using the term African-American was affirming their place in society. Or like in the media, it would have a negative slant to it of just saying blacks. And so part of it is the language we use. And I found in this book, I'm saddened that it uses the term blacks, which to me comes off as a slight more negative or derogatory versus black people or African Americans. Each of you will have different perspectives, and each of you will wrestle with, well, what's the appropriate thing? Part of it is asking your African American friends, like, okay, I'm an ignorant white person. When I'm talking about a group of people who happen to be African American, what's sort of the preferred way of addressing or describing that group? And again, not all black people are the same, so they're going to have different takes on it. But I bet you I can gain more valuable information by asking them than just sort of riding along on my own ignorant assumptions. So asking them from their standpoint, what's the preferred ways of referencing, or what ways of referencing are not helpful or are signals of like, yeah, this is not a safe person to talk to. So in terms of African Americans, I think that the book did an excellent job of laying out the history of African Americans in the U.S., and we're going to watch a short video clip that just, again, chronicles the social reality of African Americans in the U.S.
I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Human progress is neither automatic nor inevitable. Welcome to WatchMojo.com, and today we'll be learning more about the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. The end of the American Civil War in 1865 effectively meant the end of slavery, but African Americans were in for a long struggle before they were finally awarded equal rights. As of 1870, all eligible male citizens were able to vote. However, blacks were discouraged to by violence and eventually legal stipulations. In 1896, the Supreme Court ruled to maintain racial segregation in private businesses in a case called Plessy v. Ferguson. Soon broadened to include schools, many southern states applied this separate but equal mentality to all aspects of life. However, this led to the application of Jim Crow laws, which resulted in blacks being treated as second-class citizens. Segregated schools, public transit, restrooms, water fountains, and more continued well into the 1900s. In 1909, a group of prominent black and white campaigners created the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP. Their goal was to increase racial equality and challenge issues like the Jim Crow laws. Unfortunately, it was between 1910 and 1930 that white supremacist group the Ku Klux Klan saw its biggest expansion amid increased racial friction. Following the First World War, the NAACP was devoted to ending lynching by white vigilantes. By mid-century, the group became instrumental in the Brown versus the Board of Education of Topeka court case. This class action suit, filed in 1951, asked that segregation in schools be struck down. Taken to the Supreme Court, the case resulted in the first integrated school in the United States to open in the fall of 1955. Encouraged by the decision, the civil rights movement began to hold high-profile boycotts, marches, sit-ins, and other peaceful protests. These included 1955's Montgomery bus boycott in support of Rosa Parks. A watershed moment came in 1957 when a high school in Arkansas admitted a group of African American students nicknamed the Little Rock Nine. Protested by fellow students, the governor, and even the state's National Guard, President Dwight Eisenhower eventually intervened to ensure the students' safe passage. By 1962, universities also began integrating, though black students were still met with protests and violence. The Southern Freedom Movement continued into the 60s, with support from newly elected President John F. Kennedy and his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. The violence of the Birmingham, Alabama campaign influenced the president to fully endorse the movement.
A great change is at hand, and our task, our obligation, is to make that revolution, that change, peaceful and constructive for all.
On June 19, 1963, he proposed a civil rights bill to Congress, which was approved in 1964 after his death with support from President Lyndon Johnson. The bill struck down existing legislation that allowed for discrimination, and its approval was largely influenced by Martin Luther King Jr. and the March on Washington of August 1963.
With this faith, we will be able to transform the changing discourse of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood.
Capturing the attention of the media and the population, this event attracted hundreds of thousands of people in support of civil rights. Following that, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 ended the prejudiced voting system. Instantly effective, blacks began voting and running for public office. However, just days later, on August 11th, a violent six-day riot in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Watts resulted in 34 deaths. This was indicative of a period of racially motivated violence that occurred in the mid to late 1960s. This era also saw the rise of black power, led in large part by Stokely Carmichael, in opposition to extremists like the Ku Klux Klan. This ideology was exemplified by the Black Panther Party, which followed the principles set forth by Malcolm X. Rising to prominence in the 1950s, his radical ideas advocated militancy for blacks.
Black people are dissatisfied. They're dissatisfied not only with the white man, but they're dissatisfied with these Negroes who have been sitting around here posing as leaders and spokesmen for black people and actually making the problem worse instead of making the problem better.
He remained an influential and controversial human rights activist until his assassination in 1965. The murders of civil rights leaders continued when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in April 1968 and Robert Kennedy 2 months later. Despite racial tensions continuing into the 1990s, progress has been measurable. The election of President Barack Obama in 2008 is seen by many to be a culmination of centuries of work in favor of racial equality.
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served in a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
I'm curious to know, whether from this video or the stuff that you read, what are things that stand out to you that either you didn't know about in terms of the history of African Americans, or just like, yeah, I knew about it, but it hit me in a new way this time? Are there any particular things that stand out? Mercedes.
I think it's something that a lot of us knew, but like seeing like the whole segregation of like the schools and like the restaurants and all that, like I just can't fathom like having to walk to like the back of the bus, like having to, like not having a choice to use a different water fountain. Like black people have some sort of disease because our skin is darker. Like I just can't imagine like the people that have to actually live through that time and go through that. Like regardless of what happens today, like yeah, a lot of incidents are really bad, but compared to that, it's just like, and that was normal. So you can't do anything about it. Like if you do it now, then you're probably getting arrested or beat up or something. So it was kind of just like, you have no voice at all. And so to see the progress that has been made, I think it's just amazing. Like, it might not seem a lot to some people, but just like seeing it like over and over again is a really big deal.
Sure, yeah. And I think what strikes me is looking back, we're like, that's just almost unbelievable, like that society would operate in that way. But the reality was, that was normal, and like few people questioned it. It's this idea of what we talked about, critical race theory, that it just becomes normal, and that's just the way life is. And so my question would be, what things are we doing today that seem perfectly normal and acceptable and fine, where 30 years from now we're going to look at it and be like, I can't, you know, basically our children are going to say, I can't believe, like, you allowed that to go on. Like, what were you thinking? And yet when you're in it, there's these blinders that just sort of say, well, yeah, this is normal. This is just the way, this is how things work. And so you can look at how easily we can critique 30 years ago, but we should also be cognizant of the fact that there's probably things that we're doing right now that seem perfectly normal that 30 years from now will be like, wow, I can't believe we allowed for that. Olivia.
I mean, I think just what I was talking about earlier with the segregated grade systems, I mean, obviously, like, the white grade system that you were talking about, it's not that black people aren't allowed in it, it's just kind of how it ends up falling into place. Like, I'm in a house and we have one black girl in our entire, there's 100 people in our house and there's one black girl. So I don't know, I can imagine looking back and just seeing more of a combination of the two systems. I don't know how long that'll take, but I can imagine that in a few years.
A combination of the two,
like there being less segregation between the two races.
Yeah. Yeah. Mercedes.
I think just going off what Olivia was saying, me being a black Greek, I think a lot of that has to do with like the history behind why black Greek oppression was formed. And so I actually took a black Greek class here last semester, and I learned that there is a black Greek fraternity that was founded here in 1911. And IU in 1911 was segregated, and so I learned that the black students lived where Kirkwood is now, and the white families that live there, they opened up their homes to the black students. And so I just find it to be really interesting that this big fraternity that is big now in our council was founded during segregation. And so just going off what you were saying, like, I don't ever think that there's going to be a time where there's, like, a lot of white people in MPHC, or there are a lot of white people in like PHA and IFC. Like, that's just because, according to history, like our council was founded for black people. And yes, there are Asians and Hispanics and Caucasian people in our council, but it's mostly black because that was like the significance, because we weren't allowed into anything else. And so we have formed something for ourselves. And so there's less, I think, like, bias towards, well, you're white, we're not going to let you in. I don't think it's that. I think that a lot of white people aren't comfortable coming to join, like, one of our organizations because they see a lot of black people, and kind of vice versa. It's kind of like you go where you fit in, or you go where you think you belong. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's valid arguments for having ethnic-specific organizations on campus, especially if you're a student of color or a minority, you know. But you say, like, the black Greek system was founded for black students, but I would also say the white Greek system was founded for white students. It's not in the charter, it's just because that's all that existed was white people, so you didn't have to put it in there. Now it sort of has to be specified. So in the book, it does a good job of highlighting certain misperceptions that we have. And one of them is the idea that legalized discrimination and segregation ended with slavery. So the thought is, over 150 years ago, legalized discrimination and segregation ended with slavery. But that's actually a misperception. That's not reality. And really what persisted for another 100 years, essentially 100 years after the end of slavery, was a form of discrimination and segregation that was more or less legal, and is what's known as the Jim Crow laws. And the Jim Crow laws were essentially this idea of separate but equal. So separate institutions, separate facilities, separate schools, separate ways of functioning in society, but that each would be equal. So the white population would have equal resources as the colored or non-white or black population. But was it really equal? And that's what ushered in the civil rights era, was that, yes, it's clearly separate, but not necessarily equal along several dimensions. And we're going to watch a video clip that explains a little bit about the Jim Crow laws, because we might hear about it today, like references to Jim Crow, but not really know what that era was like and how it came about. So this first video gives a brief overview of the Jim Crow laws, and in particular, the Supreme Court case called Plessy versus Ferguson. And really, it was the Supreme Court decision of Plessy versus Ferguson that ushered in this whole concept of separate but equal, which lasted for more or less 100 years following the Supreme Court decision, which was eventually then overturned.
By 1877, Reconstruction had succumbed to bitter opposition and backroom politics. Federal troops then occupying the South were withdrawn, and white supremacists were left to reestablish the racial hierarchy that had existed before the war. Across the former Confederacy, informal practices of racial discrimination were written into law. States instituted poll taxes, literacy tests, and other requirements that disenfranchised Negroes. They passed Jim Crow laws, which imposed segregation and other restrictions on blacks. A few blacks challenged the system of legal discrimination. In New Orleans, a man named Homer Plessy deliberately defied the Louisiana state law requiring separate rail cars for blacks and whites. He was arrested and jailed. But the incident led eventually to the Supreme Court case Plessy versus Ferguson. Plessy argued that the law infringed on his 14th Amendment right to equal protection. But the majority of justices disagreed. The court's opinion read in part,
"Legislation is powerless to eradicate racial instincts or to abolish distinctions based upon physical differences. If one race be inferior to the other socially, the Constitution of the United States cannot put them upon the same plane."
The court affirmed that segregation was constitutional as long as accommodations were separate but equal. It also left it up to the individual states, not the federal government, to guarantee equal standards. As the lone dissenting opinion, Justice John Marshall Harlan wrote,
"The thin disguise of equal accommodations will not mislead anyone, nor atone for the wrong this day done."
Plessy versus Ferguson became a landmark decision. It sanctioned a system of institutionalized racism that would persist for decades, one that would require a second period of Reconstruction to overcome.
You know, the question is, if slavery was ended over 150 years ago, why do we still need affirmative action? So in a sense, five generations have existed without slavery. And so surely that's enough time to reestablish a presence within society, in a strong presence. But there's this idea of, in finance, it's called compounding interest. Like if you invest a little money early on, and it'll, over time it'll compound and build. And in the same way, if you have a little bit of debt that you don't take care of, it'll grow and grow and grow to where you're at a greater and greater deficit. Sociologically, there's this idea of cumulative advantage and cumulative disadvantage. And so if you think about it in terms of finances, it's pretty clear, because you sort of have interest-bearing investments where your assets increase in value. And over time, you know, and that's something that you can pass on from generation to generation, this accumulated wealth. But there's also social advantages, cumulative social advantages. And in the same way, there's cumulative social disadvantages. So if one generation gets poor or no education, then that disadvantage will be passed on to the next generation. And it could actually get worse for that next generation. You know, there's this story of, it's an allegory of a father talking to his son who was like all proud of his accomplishments and was jumping around with excitement saying, "Hey, look at me, look at me." And the father just shoots back at his son. He's like, "Son, why are you acting like you hit a home run when in reality you started life on third base?" And the idea is that, you know, we might think, "Hey, look at me, look what I've accomplished." But a lot depends on where you started. And that puts in perspective what you actually accomplished. It's not to minimize the accomplishment, but it's to put it in perspective. And if you think about it in terms of society is running a race, let's say a 100-meter race, and the idea is that socially, not everyone starts the race at the same place. So your position of where you start, your social position, will influence your outcome in the race or how fast you'll get to the finish line. So imagine someone starts at the original starting line, but then someone has a social position that's of great advantage, and so they actually get to move up closer to the finish line. And so their social position influences where they start the race. And then also the social resources will influence how they perform in the race. So you think of social resources as like the equipment that you have, the types of shoes that you're wearing or the gear that you have, but not only that, but also the training facilities that you have and the coaches and all the different social resources that you have in place are going to influence how you perform in this race. And so it isn't just sort of like, hey, it's a level playing field. We all start off at the same place. That's not true. Your social position and your social resources influence your outcomes. Now, it's not to say that individual effort doesn't matter. It just means that individual effort isn't the whole story. And I think that's an important thing to remember throughout, that there's individual effort is still important and critical to this equation, but there's other factors, which I would call structural factors, which influence the social position and the social resources that we have. So I want you guys to think about, or no, actually I'll ask a question. How many of you have been in a situation where you've done something illegal or something that might have been perceived as being illegal or questionable, possibly illegal, and you've been pulled over or questioned by a police officer? So think about a scenario where you've done something illegal or something that was potentially illegal. I'm not going to ask you what you did, and this won't go on your record or anything. And in that situation, you were either questioned by a police officer, like a police officer entered into the situation and asked you some questions, or you were pulled over on your car. So that's the first question. If you've ever done anything illegal and you've been approached by a cop, raise your hand. Now, keep your hand raised. If you're able to avoid getting a ticket or arrested, keep your hand raised. Okay. So you can put your hands down now. So the thing that I want to illustrate is differences in people doing illegal or criminal activity and then the outcomes of that. And what I want you to do is now turn to someone next to you, and you can disclose as much as you want, but basically I want you just to describe the scenario of what went down when you actually were able to get out of getting a ticket or get arrested. So just turn to someone next to you and just share about the experience. You can self-disclose as much as you want, but it's more to illustrate how the legal system works in this situation in your favor. Okay, so would anyone be... These are sort of the glory stories, so I think hopefully someone will be willing to share, because this is when you got away with something. And again, we won't hold this against you, but would anyone be willing to share just sort of the scenario of how you were able to avoid getting a ticket or getting arrested in some way? Anyone have a good story?
Just recently, on the way home, I went back to Chicago for Labor Day, and I was like in the middle of Indiana, like middle of nowhere, and I was going 90, and a cop pulled me over, and he asked me why I was going so fast, and I just said, because I'm really stupid, and then he laughed and just let me go, so no ticket or anything, so that was really nice of him.
Any other stories? Surely you guys have gotten away with something. And this was a judgment call of the police officer, so it's not like you're hiding something. It's the police officer had the option of whether or not to give you the ticket, and when he decided not to give you the ticket, you're innocent. Like, he can't come back to you a year from now and say, remember, you know, it's like done with, so.
Yeah, last spring, me and five of my buddies went up to Purdue on Thursday and then came back like early Friday morning. We'd all been drinking.
Uh-huh.
And like we were in this like my buddy's small car, so we all just piled on top, and we just reeked of booze, and we got pulled over on 37, and the cop just asked what we were doing. We told him, and he's like, "All right, go sleep." And that was it.
Uh huh.
Didn't care at all.
Yeah, yeah. What strikes me about situations is that within the legal system, there are judgment calls. The police have authority; they have leniency in which laws they're going to enforce. And which ones they're going to, not necessarily turn a blind eye to, but sort of give a get-out-of-jail-free card, where they're going to say, hey, I'm just going to give you a warning, don't do it again. But what's interesting is that it is a judgment call of which laws are enforced and which people they're enforced upon. And there's a professor at Ohio State, Michelle Alexander. She's a law professor, and she wrote a book called The New Jim Crow Laws, or The New Jim Crow. And what she contests is that just because the Jim Crow laws have been overturned with the Civil Rights era, that we've entered into an era of the new Jim Crow, where it's no longer separate but equal, but there's certain institutional structures that have been put back in place, or implicitly put in place, that perpetuate this sense of discrimination or unequal treatment. It's been turned into a movie. We're going to watch a little bit of it to explain sort of what the new Jim Crow laws are and how they relate.
That new system of racial and social control has emerged from the ashes of slavery and Jim Crow. It's a system that shuttles our children from decrepit and underfunded schools to brand new high-tech prisons. This system of mass incarceration locks poor people, overwhelmingly poor people of color, into a permanent second-class status for life, nearly as effectively as earlier systems of racial and social control once did. It is, in my view, the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. There was time when I thought that claims and analogies comparing mass incarceration to slavery or mass incarceration to Jim Crow were exaggerations, were distortions, were actually more likely to do harm than good to efforts to reform the criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But what a difference a decade makes. For after years of working on issues of racial profiling and police brutality and drug law enforcement in poor communities of color, and attempting to, quote unquote, assist people reenter into a society that had shown no particular use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is so obvious to me now that what stuns me in retrospect is that I have remained blind to it for so long. I state my conclusion in the introduction where I write, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it.
So this is Michelle's opinion. This is her theory, that she's saying the Jim Crow laws that led to greater discrimination and unequal treatment is perceived to have been abolished. And she would contend that, no, actually, in particular, with the criminal justice system, is a new way of implementing a form of Jim Crow laws. Now, that's her opinion. I think we, as scholars and students, need to look at evidence or facts. And as a sociologist, I think one of the things that I love about sociology is oftentimes what social science data provides is social facts. It's just sort of what is reality? What is the social reality? And one of those would be, within the criminal justice system, are there certain data that would give evidence or credence to the fact that, yeah, there is some form of unequal treatment or unequal distribution of punishments going on? And so this next video provides what I would describe as social facts, and then with those social facts, we can sort of then enter into a discussion of, okay, are these facts compelling or not? This is the social reality. Right now, we're just sort of sitting here with our own experiences of, yeah, you know, if you commit a crime, you go to jail and there's consequences, you know, that's it. But what if the enforcement of certain crimes for certain people varies by race or varies by class? What if people of a lower class actually end up getting convicted more often than people of a higher class? Or what if certain crimes are singled out as being more enforceable or greater punishment than other crimes? And so this next video provides some of the data related to the criminal justice system.
The racial composition of the prison population in the United States is very different from the population at large. If people are worried about inequality in America today, I think this deserves more attention in the discussion. Racial inequality in the criminal justice system gets ignored because it doesn't affect most people. In 2010, over 1.6 million people were in state and federal prisons within the United States. So 497 out of every 100,000 Americans were in jail. About half of 1%. Less than 1%. That doesn't seem very large, but when you separate that population by race, you recognize that the personal effects of the criminal justice system are very unequally shared throughout our society. Whites make up 64% of the total population, but only 31% of the incarcerated population. Blacks represent 14% of society, but 36% of the prison population. Hispanics are 16% of America, but 24% of the American prison population. Less than 1 in 100 Americans are currently in jail, but for some races, genders, and age groups, that ratio is a lot larger. For example, if you're young, black, and male, it's closer to about 1 in 4. That means you'd have a higher probability of going to jail than of getting married or going to college. These results are unequal and problematic, as poor black communities lack so many of their members. But what can be done? The causes of this trend are undoubtedly complicated and multi-causal. But there is reason to suggest that part of the blame is our criminal justice system itself. In the ways police officers enforce laws, in the ways that laws are written and prosecuted, and more. In many cases, it is not overt racism by individual actors. Many police officers, prosecutors, and judges are undoubtedly trying to be fair and trying to do the right thing. But economics can explain how unequal enforcement of the criminal law happens anyway. This is because the political and bureaucratic structure of the criminal justice system creates perverse incentives. The formal laws surrounding drug prohibition, for example, are written as if to be colorblind. but people with different levels of wealth face different costs and benefits to participating in the drug trade. Different groups consume different drugs at different rates, and lastly, those groups are politically represented in very different quantities. Thus, they are arrested and incarcerated at very different rates. How could minority groups hope to use the political process to fix inequality when they are systematically over-incarcerated and disenfranchised? Despite noble intentions, politics often does not affect the basic incentives of costs and benefits faced by political or citizen actors. We might need a new approach to social change if we are going to address these problems. We definitely need more study into the causes of inequality, and we should admit that radical changes might be both necessary and preferable to the status quo.
The thing that strikes me, and again, this is hard for me to digest, like I still have a reaction to it because I still, in a sense, was raised, if you break the law, you have to suffer the consequences. But if I reflect back in my own life experience, I feel like I've gotten away with a lot of stuff that if I was someone of a different race or a different class, I probably would have been either arrested or gotten a ticket or something like that. Now, we tend to forget about the times when we get away with it, and we just sort of move on. And I think two things stand out. When I think about drug use, and in particular marijuana use, the statistics are that white people compared to black people consume marijuana at the same levels. You know, the same proportion of the white population consumes marijuana as the black population, and yet the convictions of marijuana use are way out proportion by African Americans. So even though both groups are using it, the enforcement of it and the convictions of it is way out proportioned by African Americans. So that alone just sort of, I'm like, that's interesting. If I think about my own experience with people using drugs in, say, a white upper middle class environment, convictions were rare. Whereas if you look at other statistics within other communities, convictions are a lot higher. And the same would be, you know, I think of driving violations or speeding tickets, traffic violations, that with racial profiling or different forms of racial profiling, if a certain population is getting pulled over more often just for routine checks, they're going to have a higher proportion of finding something wrong with your vehicle or in your vehicle, whereas if you aren't pulled over. So, you know, you can say, well, these people, if they're arrested, they did something wrong. But part of that is that they are pulled over more often, or people within that population are pulled over more often. So how does this relate to employment in the workforce and managing workforce diversity? There's a movement, it's a controversial movement, it's called Ban the Box. So Ban the Box is when you fill out an application, you fill this out with your college applications, but also employment applications, there's a box that says, have you been convicted of a crime? And if so, you need to check that box. Now, if you're an employer and you're sifting through applications and you see that that box has been checked, chances are that's automatic dismissal of that applicant. Why take the risk? Without even knowing anything about the scenario or the situation, you take that application and chances are you're just going to toss it. Because it's like, why do I want a felon working for my company? And yet there's a much bigger picture or story behind every person who checks that box that might influence whether or not you would actually want to hire them or not hire them. And so there's this movement called Ban the Box, and I'm going to show a quick clip of someone describing the heart behind this idea of saying that that box shouldn't be the first thing on the application. Like maybe, yes, disclosing it, but later on in the hiring process. Sort of like when you, I don't know if this happens with college, but definitely with employment, after you've been almost hired or they decide they want to hire you, they do a background check of different things, but it's very sort of, hey, let's just make sure that there's no surprises in there. But we've already decided we want you, and unless there's something egregious that we didn't know about, you have the job. And so the idea of Ban the Box isn't just turn a blind eye to anything that's happened in the past, but just do it much, much later in the hiring process.
Ban the Box is the movement that removes the box, asking about a person's conviction history. So when a person is applying for a job now, it's typical for there to be a box that says, have you ever been convicted of a felony?
Well, there's been a movement to eradicate that box, to eliminate that box. And when I ask him to overall completely not ask that question, we're saying put it later on in the process. Once the person has been found eligible and qualified, before they offer them the job, they can inquire about that. And then a person has the right to be able to explain. The challenge is when you submit an application or you are asked in any interview about any conviction history, then what that normally triggers behind the stigma associated behind fear, that the person, if they're not trained, they're going to discriminate. That application may not make it past that day. The reality of the conditions that we live under forces many of us to live in the informal economy, in the informal market, that makes us do crimes we don't have to do.
Are you comfortable saying what that crime was?
Not necessarily. I'd rather focus on the message that I have and why should we focus on someone's past, where the whole character is not measured by one action or event, but rather by the overall character.
Somebody might say that there are, you know, frequent incidences of people exiting prison and then committing a crime and going right back to prison. So from the employer's perspective, why should they take that risk?
Well, the question that we normally ask most people, when is enough enough? You know, if we got sentenced at 19, like in my case, 20 years old, and I'm 36 now, why should I be sentenced 16 years later, be under the same sentence of not being able to stay in my family? And then be forced to live off the informal economy that comes with all the managing you underneath. And this should always be a nexus between the job responsibility and the actual conviction. So if I was convicted of DUI back in 96, and all of a sudden I'm applying now in 2015 for a job that doesn't require any driving, that conviction should not be used to judge me in obtaining this job if I have all the qualifications with other lists allowing me to work there.
So this is extremely complicated, I think. You know, it's not as straightforward as, okay, everyone's on a level playing field. If you committed a crime, there's consequences, and then it's going to affect future employment opportunities. If that was the case, then it would be a fair system. But if there's already inequality in the enforcement of the criminal justice system, then that needs to be taken into consideration on the back end with people who are applying for jobs. And the reason why it's relevant to this class is you all will be in a position of employing people. And so then the question that you'll have to face is, if you get a set of applications and you see that box and it's checked, are your hiring practices, how are you going to deal with the fact that a person has a felony? And I think what they shared of, like, what happens if this felony occurred when the person was 19 years old and they're now 45? You wouldn't know that if you sort of had a basic policy of, we're not going to hire criminals. You just toss the application. So I want to break up into four groups, and we're going to debate whether or not a business should have a ban the box policy in their hiring process. So we'll go with this group up here. You guys are going to be for banning the box, basically that's not going to be a part of the initial hiring process. So then you guys are against banning the box, and then the back group here is going to be for banning the box. So basically, come up, you're going to do like we did before, where you're going to come up with arguments. You're basically going to persuade your classmates that you should ban the box. You're going to say, no, we shouldn't ban the box, that's a poor policy. And you guys are going to say, yes, we should ban the box. I mean, here's reasons why. So even if you don't agree with it, I want you to take the position of whatever you've been assigned to and come up with good arguments for that. So you have 3 minutes to come up with your argument, and make sure you have a scribe and a spokesperson. Okay, you guys ready? We'll start with this group, and the person who's the spokesperson, stand up, make your case for why some form of banning the box should be implemented. Okay, Sam has the floor.
So a lot of the reasons we talked about were pretty much based on what we heard in the video. So we agree with a lot of things that the guy was saying who's initiating this type of campaign. So you may not know the entire story of what happened, or we could say that they may have just been in the wrong place at the wrong time with a friend, and we don't know the whole story if you just automatically put this box at the beginning of an application process and make them say that they were convicted and not ever give them the chance to explain themselves before you move on with them. And we also said, talking about like our personal applications that we've filled out, and they usually give you one line to say, like, if you're convicted of a felony, explain why. And that's not really enough room to go in depth and give your story. So we are pro ban the box.
Cool. Thank you, Sam. Now, the people who are opposed to this Ban the Box campaign, who's the spokesperson? Okay.
We looked at it from like an employer standpoint. Like, if I'm employing you or anybody here, I have a right to know. I mean, I'm not discriminating against you by knowing that. It's really, really expensive to hire a new employee, depending on the company, but usually it's incredibly expensive. If I think that you're going to go screw up or hurt my business by doing something, then there's no reason that I want to hire you. So it's kind of right off the bat, I just don't want you as an employee.
Regardless of what the felony was.
Maybe I don't have time to vet every single person
sure.
who's been convicted of a felony.
Yep.
So. Okay.
And in the back here.
We are for Ban the Box, but we didn't really say much different than what they said. Besides that, like, there's no reason to like disqualify a person if they're qualified just because of a crime they've committed in the past that
mm-hmm.
could have no effect on the job at hand.
Mm-hmm. So. Very good. So, from an economics perspective, Ban the Box is a very inefficient campaign. Think about it. You have 100 applications for one position, and you're thinking, I need to efficiently eliminate people for consideration. And so a very efficient criteria is, have they been convicted of a felony? And so to actually have to take time to discover the story behind the felony, like when did it occur, what was the crime, takes a lot of time. And in this course, and as we talk about managing diversity, I'm not making an economic argument. You know, because I think from a cost-benefit analysis, there's reasons to be homogeneous in your hiring practices or hire people who are similar to you or like you. But I think there are social arguments for why you as an employer could maybe lead your organization in a way such that you would step back and say, let's sort of challenge or critically look at some of our hiring practices and how they might be subtly discriminatory, or based on the society that we live in and how there's unequal distribution of resources or of punishments. And so, again, there are very good economic reasons why that box should be there and other policies. That's why they're there. They're in place to make the hiring process more efficient. But I would argue that there could be social reasons for why one might want to consider changing the hiring practices. Now, Ban the Box is an extreme case, but I think it highlights the reality that when you're embedded in a society where there is, where the criminal justice system is unequal in its enforcement, there's implications on the back end for employment. You know, they talked about the informal economy or the recidivism rate of committing a crime, going to jail, and then going back into jail. Part of that is because it's much harder to find a job once you get out of jail because you now have a criminal record. And so it's this self-perpetuating situation. So as I think about this course, and we talk about managing diversity, and now we're looking at different racial groups, as I was thinking about this lecture, and it's like, okay, managing diversity, okay, now we're talking about African Americans, so we're going to talk about managing black people. And as I said that to myself, I was like, managing black people, that sounds kind of a strange picture, managing black people. And I was like, is that really what this course is about, is how to manage black people and how to manage Asian people? And I would say, no, that's where a misnomer in this class of managing diversity, the idea of managing, isn't really the best way to think about it. And what I think about in the terms of when you have a diverse organization or if you have African Americans in your organizations, it's not about managing, but it's about understanding and navigating social differences. So in order to be an effective manager, or really an effective leader, it's understanding the social differences within your organization and navigating those social differences and ultimately leveraging those social differences to advance the goals of the organization And so I want you to write down on a piece of paper a situation where you've had a meaningful interaction with a black person. So think about a time in your life where you've actually had a meaningful interaction with a black person and what you learned through that experience. So a meaningful interaction would be where you had a conversation, basically where you had a conversation. And then if you've never had a meaningful interaction with a black person, I want you to consider why not. You know, is it just, I've never had the opportunity, I've never taken the opportunity. And then if you are a black person, I want you to think about the first time when you first became cognizant of being black, of your blackness. Think about sort of when it sort of hit you, like, huh, I'm a black person in a predominantly white society. So just a moment where that just sort of was crystallized for you, where you're like, huh, I'm black, and that matters in this social context. So the three scenarios would be the meaningful interaction that you've had with a black person, if you've never had a meaningful interaction, and then if you are a black person, when you first became cognizant of being black. And now I want you to pair up and just share about that experience of the meaningful interaction or the lack of interaction, or if you are black, when it hit you that, huh, the color of my skin matters. So pair up and share with the other person your experience. Okay, would someone be willing to share about their experience? Sam.
We have a really large family. There's like 103 of us, just stemming from my grandparents. And two of my cousins are mixed out of our entire family. So my one cousin's closer to my age, and she's like 10 or 12 years older than her younger brother. So like growing up with all of us, like she was the only one in our family who wasn't completely white. So we like got to talking a couple years ago. And she said she always felt kind of weird about it because her dad, like, was never in the picture, so, like, we never understood their dynamics. Mm. But I think it's definitely better now. Like, we're always together, but...
Good. Anyone else would be willing to share? Mercedes?
I realized that I was black when I moved to Indiana. In fifth grade, I grew up in Hawaii because my family's military. And so there's a lot of everybody, so like Filipino and Samoan and Hawaiian and Hispanic and black and Caucasian. So it was never like, oh, you're the black person in the class, because there's a mix of everyone. And so when I moved to Indiana in like elementary, middle school, like I was the only black person in all of my classes, and I was like, oh, this sucks. And it was really weird because like everybody was looking at me like, you don't belong. But then at the same time, like everybody's really fascinated, like, hey, we had a black kid now. So it was just like, it's like an Indiana thing, I guess, because nowhere else that I've lived has been like this.
Tucker.
Yeah, I used to TA for one of my teachers in high school, and like every class I would just get a pass and go play chess with my black wrestling coach. It was just like interesting to hear his perspective on a lot of things, even though we were like just playing a game, we were like talking about real stuff too, so it's kind of interesting to get another perspective.
Sure, yeah. Some of you in your memo said, what's the political, you know, we talked about, is it blacks, is it black people, is it capital B or lowercase b, is it African Americans, what's respectful, what's politically correct, what's going to be offensive, and there's no one answer to that. But what I think it raises up for me is this idea of, you know, I don't want to be walking on eggshells, and in a sense, if I don't know what to say, my default is to not say anything, and that's not helpful. And I think if I talk to someone who is a minority race or someone who's African American or anyone, in reality, what people don't want is to be misunderstood. Like, I don't want to be pigeonholed as being something that I'm not. I don't want to be labeled as something that I'm not. Regardless of what your race is, I think there's this inherent value of, like, don't misrepresent me. Get to know who I am. And I think part of the exercise of understanding and navigating social differences involves actually having conversations. So when you talk with your wrestling coach, it's not like your wrestling coach is the authority for all black people, but it's going from having no contact with black people to having one encounter and then you build on that to get the diversity of perspectives and opinions. There's a great video on BuzzFeed that we're going to conclude with. The title of it is, If Black People Said the Things That White People Say. And it highlights the ways that black people get caricatured or misunderstood by white people. And I think, to me, that's the driving thing of, like, not what's the politically correct thing to say, but more so, what are our ways of being in interaction that make these different assumptions?
Wait a minute, you don't listen to Taylor Swift?
No. Girl, I'm, like, whiter than you.
Was it hard to grow up in the suburbs? It must have been really boring with no police activity or anything.
Your hair is amazing. You know, it's kind of like my golden retriever. It's so new and lifeless. Like, how do you do that?
Oh, wow.
Your name is so easy to spell and pronounce. Isn't it really easy to get a job?
Check out these photos of me volunteering at an orphanage in Europe. Those
cool.
Little white boys and girls, they were so inspiring.
Oh, wow. No, you don't sound like a dumb hick at all. That's so cool.
You are so pretty for a white girl.
It's really sad when Romney lost, huh? Good old Mitt. Couldn't do it. Could not do it.
You were dating a white guy. Does he have, like, a really tiny penis?
Oh, you must listen to that rural music, right?
You know who you look just like.
Oh, Jennifer Lawrence.
So we just saw Titanic. How are you dealing? I had no idea your people had it so hard.
Your skin is so pale. Can I touch it?
Wow. No, I was just talking about that with my friend Jeremy. He's white, too.
I don't even think of you as white. I don't. I really don't. Wow. So you have to wear sunscreen? That is so crazy.
Hey, I'm from out of town. Can you help me find some meth? What do you mean you don't live in that old boy? You're white.
I've always heard that white girls are, like, super boring in bed.
Oh, hey.
Yo. What's up, my crack? Oh, no, nah, man, it's cool. You know, I can say it. My girlfriend's white.
Yeah, not cool, man.
Oh, okay. My bad, Daniel. My bad.
It's crack.
All right. Have a good weekend.